You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Ibrahim Saif. I am a resident scholar working here at Carnegie. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome our guest from Human Rights Watch to have this event jointly organized to under the title Back to Tahrir, Egypt's ongoing crisis. And I must say that I'm glad, as being an economist and introducing the Human Rights Watch is something that I never entertained. Just I'm taking advantage that the director of our office, Dr. Paul Salim, is traveling and he couldn't make it. So we hope to have an interesting discussion with our three guests. Back to Tahrir, Egypt's ongoing crisis. I think from the title you could tell that. Last night I attended the annual dinner of the Human Rights Watch when one of our speakers, Hussam Bahjat, said that instead of gathered here and celebrating the downfall of Mubarak, we are here discussing the future. We are also again back to a kind of square zero, discussing real issues and real politics in Egypt and what is happening with the dominance of the military council and what the future looks like with some of the old practice of oppression is rising again. I will not take much of the speakers. We have three speakers. I will introduce them and then we'll open the floor for each one of them for 10 to 15 minutes and then we hope to have a discussion with yourselves. Hussam Bahjat, an activist at the beginning, he is the founder and director of the Egyptians Initiative for Personal Rights and the leading defender of civil rights and liberties in Egypt. Bahjat is also an outspoken critic of Mubarak's government violation of basic rights, including abuses committed by Egyptian powerful security apparatus under the country's 29-year state of emergency. And he played a prominent role as revolution swept in Egypt in January and February 2011. And I can tell you last night he was awarded a prize from the Human Rights Watch for all what he has done. Our second speaker is Kenneth Roth, is the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. He is one of the world's leading international human rights organization which operates in more than 80 countries. He has written extensively on a wide range of human rights abuses, devoting special attention to issues of international justice, the foreign policy, the major power, and the work of the United Nations and the rest of the world. Third speaker is our colleague Anthony Shadid. He is the Beirut chief of the New York Times. Over 15 years career, he has reported from most countries in the Middle East. He has won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting twice, when the United States invaded Iraq and when they left Iraq as well. So it's great pleasure to have this speakers here. And the floor is yours, Hussam, please.
Thank you very much, Ibrahim. Thank you to our colleagues at the Carnegie Middle East Center and Human Rights Watch for organizing this and for allowing me this opportunity to share with you some general observations about what we're going through in Egypt. I say general observations with a lot of hesitation. The last 2 weeks in particular, I mean the last 10 months, of course, the most prominent word, the most commonly used word used to describe Egypt as other countries going through the Arab Spring is the word fluid, of course. And so the situation, and we've come to dislike this word almost as we used to dislike the word stability. But despite the fluidity of the situation, we had at least some grasp over what was taking place. But I have to admit, as a caveat in the beginning that the last 2 weeks have left many of us puzzled and humbled also about the extent of our ability to predict what is happening, to understand the tipping point at any given situation, and how people choose to react to these proverbial tipping points. The first time was 2 weeks ago when people decided to gather again, not only in Tahrir Square but throughout the country in massive protests and demonstrations against military rule, against the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. And then we had a second surprise last Monday on the first day of the first round of elections with the massive turnout and the decision by millions of Egyptians to go out and queue for many hours under the rain to cast their vote. And in both cases, I don't think any pundit was expecting any of these developments to take place. So that it is, with this caveat that that I would like to address a few main points here. The first is to just take stock of where we stand right now, almost 11 months after the beginning of this uprising and the removal of Mubarak. The general feeling that we have in Egypt is that almost 10 months later, the main challenge we are facing with regard to the transition is that the transition has not started, that the transition refuses to start, that we feel and constantly feel frustrated that our revolution was arrested in March of last year, and that we've been struggling for the past few months to liberate this revolution. When we talk about the transition, we're usually thinking about an end of past practices, achieving justice for crimes of the past, seeking the truth about what happened over the last 30 decades and how it happened, engaging in institutional reform for the future to rebuild the democratic institutions that had been systemically undermined and destroyed by the Mubarak regime, so that we can have institutions that could carry our democratic system in the future and guard it. Working not just to ensure the emergence of a democratic government, but also of a democratic society, especially with regard to the protection of women's rights and of minorities, especially religious and ethnic minorities, and working, of course, to strive for economic and social justice, given that economic injustice was one of the most important and prominent factors that led to the revolution in January. And on every one of these levels, if we walk through the list, I think everyone will agree that we haven't really achieved much with regard to the past or the present or the future. And instead, we find ourselves completely overwhelmed by this fresh wave of fresh violations and abuses committed by the military regime or with the consent of the military regime that we have right now, and with the emergence of a new form of impunity for military personnel, in addition to the older impunity enjoyed by the civilian security apparatus. Over the months, our own perception of the role played by SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, changed. In February, we were not, none of us was naive to think that the leaders of the armed forces had made a decision to join the revolution, but we were still willing to give them the benefit of having made a decision to unseat their own commander-in-chief and to not shoot at the people or use the brutality that we saw in Libya or Syria afterwards. And so we were willing to give them the advantage, the benefit of the doubt. When the violations started to come to light in March and April and during the spring, and when they started interfering with the work of the independent media to prevent the coverage of these violations, whether the excessive use of military trials for civilians or torture by the military police, or infamous incident of subjecting female protesters in March to virginity tests in a detention center run by the military police in the Egyptian Museum. When all of this was happening, when they passed a state budget, an annual budget that looked remarkably similar to the Mubarak era budgets, we again were prepared to blame most of these blunders and mistakes on inexperience and incompetence, the fact that these military officers had inherited a job without any proper training on how to deliver services, engage in law and order and law enforcement activities, as well as lead the transition. By the summer, it was the discourse of the military council and their conduct significantly shifted in terms of their decision to sideline the civilian transitional cabinet and to start micromanaging a lot of what was happening in Egypt, both in terms of the state departments and functions, as well as in leading the transition. But also, it seems that they had reached a point where they became genuinely convinced that there is a foreign conspiracy, that there is this elaborate external conspiracy by a number of foreign forces to destabilize Egypt, because a weaker Egypt was in the interest of other regional powers. These are sometimes Israel, sometimes Qatar, sometimes Iran, Turkey. Of course, with U.S. funding, with Hamas involved, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and grantees of the U.S. government funding, it's not really a coherent theory, but it was remarkably genuine. It was not as cynical as the Mubarak regime discourse used to be. Every response by the military council turned out to have been based on this premise, the premise that there is an external conspiracy, and like any conspiracy, it has enemies within that were working to service this conspiracy to destabilize Egypt. And the enemies within are independent media, independent human rights organizations, and the youth coalitions, April 6 youth movement and the Revolutionary Youth Coalition and other youth movements that were part of the revolution. And so suddenly, we started facing last summer military officers that became very paranoid and xenophobic and angry, extremely sensitive to criticism, extremely convinced that only they were patriotic, and that anyone that dared criticize them or speak out against any of their violations must be part of this conspiracy. And we started seeing this statement in every, this phrase in every single statement issued by the military council of attempt to, quote, drive a wedge between the people and the army. And that's how that became the way, the prism through which our military rulers started reading every scenario and reading every challenge, that all of this was just an attempt to tarnish the reputation of the army and drive a wedge between the people and the army in order to destabilize the military. That, of course, started to become a very prominent theme in all the statements of the military, and then it became clear that this was not their new reading of the new situation, but it's also their already existing reading of what happened in January. They seem to also believe now that what had happened in January is that there was this coming together of these factors, of these foreign forces and enemies within that succeeded in agitating people against the existing regime using legitimate grievances that people felt. But in the eyes of the military, it also became clear that they think that the only problems Egypt had before January were the two problems of Mubarak and his family and his succession plan, his plan to pass the presidency on to his son after him, and secondly, the problem of financial corruption, excessive financial corruption, and the business elite that came to work together with the Mubarak family to embezzle state funds. But apart from this, they seem to feel that everything was going perfectly well, and that the attempts, our attempts to change anything else, like effect security sector reform or work for judicial independence or rebuild any of the state institutions, are cynical ploys to undermine what they call the basic foundations of the Egyptian state. And so they feel that minus Mubarak, minus corruption, everything was going well. That was coupled by or accompanied by the emergence of a new actor that I feel we, both in the human rights community as well as in the research community, need to do more to analyze and understand, which is the role of the Egyptian General Intelligence Service, the Mukhabarat al-Amma, the body that used to be chaired by Omar Suleiman before he was made vice president to Mubarak before the, or during the uprising, and that was left completely intact after the revolution, but was actually granted with a big and burgeoning brief of domestic security affairs, in addition to the regional security issues like Iran and Hamas and Iraq, etc. Now they manage a lot of the domestic political issues as well that used to be handled under Mubarak by the State Security Investigation Unit of the Interior Ministry. This is the Aegis, or the Egyptian General Intelligence Service, is the body that ran exclusively, or was the first to collaborate with the U.S., of course, in its Extraordinary Rendition program, even before it was called Extraordinary Rendition in the mid-90s. And this, I mean, it's not only involved in many human rights abuses domestically and internationally, but we believe that they are now engaged in harassing producers and presenters of critical talk shows to pressure them to host certain people or not to host certain people. They were involved recently in an incident of confiscating newspapers and ordering the print house to shred the newspapers. They are meeting and consulting with political forces and civil society about the transition, and we believe that they have come to play the role of the brain of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, but in complete secrecy and under, of course, no accountability whatsoever. The elections, of course, came as a game changer because suddenly we, as of last week, even though we've only had one day of one round of elections in nine districts out of 27, suddenly we there is this new player called the people. Suddenly it was not the Supreme Military Council on one side and the political elite on the other side, and suddenly the success of the transition is not being measured only by the ability of forces in the political elite to get their people out on the streets to put pressure on the council, but actually people made a decision for different reasons to go out en masse in this unprecedented level of participation to send a message. I mean, whether they wanted to support the political movements that they endorsed or whose ideologies they endorsed. We believe that the majority of people were actually out just to express support for the revolution or to express support for stability, for the return of normalcy, and or to make a point that things have changed after the revolution, and many middle-class families that were generally apolitical before the revolution, they came out this time, especially women, simply to register or recognize that things have become different after the revolution in this first general election. And so we believe that the level of participation, not only the results of the elections, we are going to change the way that most political forces and political movements calculate their next moves and think about their relationship with people in power. Another recent change in terms of where we find ourselves today is, of course, the fact that the issue of security sector reform came back to the forefront. We have been pushing for this since March. We have been part of meetings and discussions with colleagues in our interior ministry even then the now called national security sector that used to be called SSI. We worked with former police officers, current police officers, to articulate plans for restructuring the interior ministry out of the realization that it was the worst and most abusive piece of the of this apparatus of abuse that Mubarak ran, and that it could fail the transition if left unreformed. Everything came to stop or go into a black hole again in the summer, and it appeared that there was a conscious decision to stop this talk about security sector reform, that the challenge, the priority, was to get security back on the street and to get the interior ministry and its police force to respond to people's perception, at least, of lack of security. And they could never acknowledge the fact that they can't do one without the other, that the fact that people are complaining about lack of security, complaining about poor policing, was precisely because of the SCAF and the transitional government's failure to make any progress in terms of security sector reform. When the violence happened on November 19th, this last month, and was followed by this mass mobilization of people that came out essentially to protest the failure to secure the interior ministry and to reform and restructure the interior ministry, and then it spread to become a statement of dissatisfaction with the military management of the transition in general. Suddenly, the issue of security sector reform came back to the forefront, especially with the resignation of the Sharaf cabinet. Now everyone is waiting for a new cabinet to be appointed to get serious about security sector reform, including people inside the regime. Of course, the package of demands of, wishes that we had in February remains almost completely still untouched. And so now in our office, we call them the February dreams, Ahlam Febrayer. It's the list of projects and ideas and wish list that we engaged in, thinking of when Mubarak was unseated. And I remember the very first collective statement that we issued. I think we were 12 human rights organizations that issued a statement the morning after Mubarak's resignation. We came out with an 8-page document on the 12th of February, saying, for the transition to start, this is what you need to do immediately, and these are the laws that need to be changed, and these are the processes that need to be initiated. Most of items on this list, of course, remain unfulfilled. In terms of the end of past practices, we are still struggling against torture, documenting cases of torture, police brutality, use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. We are still working to deal with the 5,000 or so that remain out of the 13,000 civilians that were referred to military trials between February and late September. We are still dealing with military trials that are ongoing, including for terrorism cases, in cases that look completely identical to the terror trials before exceptional courts in Mubarak time. There was a decision, as you know, in late September to reactivate all of the powers in the emergency law or the state of emergency that was declared in 1981 and that the military have failed to lift and instead expanded the scope of the application of the emergency law to way beyond the scope it had under Mubarak, so that it's not only against people who pose a risk to or a threat to national security, it's now now against people who, you know, obstruct traffic, engage in thuggery, promote false information or false rumors. So it's a long list now. And of course, the emergency law came, or the state of emergency came back with state security emergency courts that do not allow the right of appeal, and that are considering at least four cases so far. The issues of economic justice and social justice, like I said, most of the policies remain the same in terms of unfair subsidies of profit-making industries, and in terms of the failure to take any measures to lift people out of poverty, or even temporarily respond to the challenges of the current economic situation. The response to sectarian violence, we've had three incidents so far of churches being burned by extremist elements in Giza, and then in Cairo, and then in Helwan, and then in Giza, and then in Aswan. And of course, the military council and the security apparatus are still responding in exactly the same manner that Mubarak used to respond to sectarian violence against Christians. There are still incidents of harassment against media, especially those that dare criticize military personnel. Unprecedented measures being taken against NGOs, including my own NGO. There is now an ongoing criminal investigation into the funding of all human rights organizations in Egypt in an attempt to force these organizations, including mine, to register under Mubarak's NGO law that we've been fighting since it came out in 2002. Suddenly now there is a fact-finding commission appointed by the cabinet, chaired by the Minister of Justice, to investigate our funding. The report of this commission was submitted to the public prosecutor with a request to initiate criminal proceedings against us, who the public prosecutor appointed two special prosecutors to work only on this file, and they went and obtained a court decision to subpoena the bank statements of 40 organizations and or 75 organizations and 40 individuals. And of course, the name of my organization is on the list that was leaked to the press, as well as the my personal bank account. And we're expecting probably criminal indictments very soon, probably coupled with a decision to freeze our bank accounts, shut down our premises while we face a trial for either just violating the NGO law by operating as law firms or as medical clinics or as civil companies and not seeking registration under Mubarak's draconian NGO law, or for more serious crimes like espionage or working against national security, which is also in circulation. The foreign policy remains unchanged, just like the domestic policy. We had 3 months of ecstasy in the first government that was appointed in March. We had Foreign Minister Nabil Al Arabi, who came after a post as a judge on the International Court of Justice, and made statements saying that Egypt is about to ratify the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and all the human rights treaties and optional protocols to allow the UN to investigate individual cases where domestic remedies fail to achieve justice. And he, made serious efforts to, support reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. He made a promise to lift the blockade on Gaza and to open the Rafah crossing, and made efforts also to normalize relations with Iran to the level of relations that are maintained between Iran and most of the Arab countries. And of course, that is what cost him his seat, and he was demoted to the position of Secretary General of the League of Arab States. And our foreign policy came back to 180 degrees, exactly to the way it was under Mubarak. Failure to have any humanitarian or moral underpinnings of our foreign policy, and failure to take any initiative, really. So to conclude, I don't think that all of this means that nothing has changed, and the elections have shown us this. The most important factor right now that has changed the way Egyptians feel about their own country and their own future is this new emerging sense of active citizenship, an unprecedented surge in volunteerism and civic engagement and youth initiatives throughout the country. Our issues as human rights defenders have been in the mainstream for 10 months, where we have always had our issues belonging to the fringe of the discussion. Now not a day passes without our issues or our colleagues being on mass media, and of course there is this sense now that Egyptians have more ownership of their destiny and of their future, and the elections came, or the first round of elections came, to emphasize this new sentiment that Egyptians feel. The enemies, of course, that are facing us right now, for me, my fear is not of the military regime or the Gulf countries or the remnants of the old regime. My biggest fear is the return of apathy, the loss of this new sense of empowerment and sense of belonging and ownership of our future. And we were all feeling progressively depressed the last few months before the elections, because it appeared that people were going back slowly but surely to the seats of spectators to watch this game play out between the military regime and the political elite, and they were losing interest again. They were returning to the sense of resignation from public policy issues. And that's why it really came as a surprise to us that people are still determined to steer this process and to have their word heard. The other enemy we're facing is the enemy of alarmism, of course, and already already, we don't have results of elections, but we are seeing, the expected sense of alarmist reaction to the results that are, reflecting a very favorable position for the Muslim Brotherhood, and a surprisingly favorable position also for the ultra-Orthodox Salafists in Egypt. That sense of alarmism and the mass hysteria that it could lead to, especially among some liberal elites and the Christian community and in some Western circles, could have a counterproductive impact on the transition. We are of the view that this is a necessary part, but painful part, of the process, that it is actually a good thing to move the Islamists from the corner of victims and martyrs to the corner of having responsibilities and having accountability and answering questions about their policy positions and their ability to govern, whether as members of parliament or as members of government. And we think that these elections were a step in the right direction, notwithstanding the preliminary results, of course, showing a strong performance by the Islamists. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this account of what's happening in Egypt. And if we to close our eyes and imagine Mubarak is still there, that tells us that much is still pretty the same, with the exception is that people at least now are in a position somehow to influence the course of events. And I must agree with this issue of apathy and the fact that people can turn into spectators, but I think the elections has proved us wrong in that way, in a way that people are really going out. But I'm sure you will have many issues to raise and discuss with Hussam, who has to leave at 6, he told me, so we'll move quickly to Mr. Kenneth Roth, the Executive Director of the Human Rights Watch, to provide us with his insight on what is happening. Please.
Well, thank you, Ibrahim, and thank you to Carnegie for sponsoring this event, or co-sponsoring, I guess, since we're playing a nominal role here, but we know who did all the work. Let me say that, as in any revolution, The revolution in Egypt faces, broadly speaking, two threats, the threats from the old regime and the threats from the revolutionaries. And I think it's useful to look at both of those and to elaborate a bit on each of them. Obviously, what's complicated in Egypt is that the revolutionaries are not, by any means, one force. And indeed, there is a very complicated interplay. I mean, even if you think about there being, broadly speaking, three players in Egypt at the moment, the SCAF, the military on the one hand, the liberals and to some extent leftists on the second, and on the third, the Islamists, the relationship among them is very complicated. And you see, for example, the liberals and the Islamists looking to each other to both try to get the military to relinquish power. You found the military, which is foremost determined to kind of maintain its economic privileges, whether it be the large share of the budget or its extensive business interests. Its foremost interest seems to be to secure a government that does not too closely scrutinize, let alone change, the relationship between the military and the state in economic terms. And it seems to have a sense that the Islamists, who have more of a social agenda, might leave them alone more than the liberals. And so there's a sort of tendency to kind of look to the Islamists for protection. But of course, there's been, decades of repression of the Islamists. That can't be forgotten. So the Islamists kind of, look to the liberals for help in building up some rights orientation that would protect them from governmental repression. You have, the liberals looking to the military to set up supra-constitutional principles to protect them from the Islamists. And of course, even the Islamists are split. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood that seems to be kind of looking more at the Turkish ideal, trying to come in as a moderate force, talking about building a broad coalition. On the other hand, you have the Salafists, who have done much better than expected, it appears, in this first round, at least, of elections, and is talking about a kind of a much more radical agenda. So it's a complicated relationship among these different elements. I wanted to begin, though, talking a bit about the SCAF. And I have to do this really, from the perspective of anything but an Egypt expert. I, my job is to cover the world, and I only get to occasionally visit Egypt. But I, I have had the advantage of visiting Egypt, numerous times over many, many years. And it is, it's interesting to me to see how the SCAF is really not in the least bit ready to operate within a democracy. I had a very odd experience meeting with a few members of the SCAF in June. I think we may have been the first human rights NGO to do that. And it was a somewhat surreal experience because, my job, brings me to meet with generals and defense ministers around the world. And I've had a bit of experience doing this. It was clear to me that the generals with whom I was meeting had virtually no experience meeting with an NGO, which was very telling because they were also not terribly eager to learn about, how this is done in a more democratic setting. So just to give you an example, one of the first things that I brought up was the problem of trying civilians before military tribunals, a problem that Hossam has, mentioned is very much continuing. And I brought this up, the way I would in any of these meetings, referring to international law and how it really frowns upon using military tribunals in this broader sense. And the general blew up at me. He started screaming. He thought this was the most outrageous thing that I, a mere NGO, would deign to tell him about what international law required. And I almost had the feeling that he's going to cut the meeting off right there. Now, we were able to calm the guy down and keep it going. But there was an immaturity about this conversation that was striking. It happened again, maybe half an hour later into the meeting, when I brought up the problem of the sort of pattern we had seen at the time of journalists writing something critical about the army and being brought in for a conversation. I sort of, joking with them a bit, said, you got to develop thicker skin. You get criticized in this world. This happens. You know, and again, he thought like I was attacking his, you know, masculinity, and he blew up at me again. You know, and it was just, it was a tumultuous meeting like that, of the sort that you just don't expect when you're dealing with, you know, a more sophisticated government. And these guys were just not ready for this. The silliest part of the meeting came when I brought up the issue of virginity tests, where, you know, you may recall, I forget the exact point, this must have been about May or so, where there had been a revival of protests in Tahrir Square, a large number of arrests, and 14 or so women, I forget the exact number, were subjected to these, you know, humiliating, invasive virginity tests. And, you know, I said, so what were you doing? And he started giving me this line about how you have to understand this is a conservative society and we had to make sure that they weren't going to be raped in custody. And I looked at him and said, you know, oh, so if they've had sex before, it's okay. You know, and, you know, the guy suddenly, you know, backed off and realized that this line wasn't going very far. And by the end of the meeting had promised, you know, no more virginity tests. But it was, there was just a, you know, a quite remarkable lack of sophistication. And it struck me that they, you know, first of all, had a lot to learn, but second, were not terribly eager to learn, that this was an institution that was used to operating on its own. The last thing that it wanted was any, you know, damn civilians looking over its shoulder. And it was, you know, not eager to relinquish power, which, of course, we've seen, whether it's, you know, in the, you know, the continued use of military tribunals, the proposal that the military would somehow be exempt from parliamentary rule, you know, one that they may be backing off on, but it's not at all clear. The complete refusal to engage in a sort of a serious investigative, let alone prosecutorial, scrutiny of the past. There have been kind of limited prosecutions for, you know, a few incidents of misconduct since January, but, you know, a really quite systematic refusal to look back. And this is, I think, part of a broader refusal to begin a process of institutional reform. You know, much of this Hossam has referred to. But if we are going to make progress in establishing a democracy in Egypt, there is a lot to be done. And there's no reason to be waiting for an elected government to take office. There are things that the SCAF could be doing at this moment were it serious, but it doesn't seem to be serious. And so, you know, that's everything from lifting the emergency law, which they continue to use to detain people, without serious due process. They could be changing elements of the penal code. For example, the provisions that outlaw insulting the army or insulting the parliamentary authorities or what have you. This is, you know, not the least, it's not at all on the agenda. Indeed, there seems to be this almost acceptance of these criminal restrictions on what should be areas of free expression. In the area of, Hossam alluded to this, you know, looking back historically, the principal source of torture in Egypt was State Security Investigation, SSI. Now, this has nominally been dissolved, but it really has just been renamed. And there has been some shuffling of personnel. We met with the Interior Ministry and they insisted that, you know, only 25 or 30% of the officers from old SSI are still in this new security force. These were only the administrative people, not the operational people who were running the torture. But there's, you know, been no open accountability as to what happened, no criteria for who stays and who doesn't, you know, no serious vetting. And so no real effort to bring state security in whatever its, you know, current name is, under the rule of law. And this, you know, again, is an invitation to the perpetuation of these kinds of practices. Already we're seeing the new security services beginning to monitor political activities. We haven't seen, it's detention and torture of people in the same way that used to happen, but there really is no impediment at this stage for the worst SSI practices to resume, because there hasn't been, you know, any wholesale restructuring of the security offices. Nor has there been any real willingness to kind of incorporate human rights law in a serious way into Egyptian law. And this is something that's going to become particularly important, you know, if the Islamists are going to gain power, because a number of these human rights provisions will be quite important. But, you know, suffice it to say, with respect to the military, and we can get into this in more detail in conversation later, the military is not acting in any sense like an institution that is about to give up power. It doesn't seem to have an inclination to do that. It has strong economic interests not to do that, and it's not taking any of the sort of basic steps that you would expect in preparation for more democratic rule. Now, let me move on to the revolutionaries, if I could, those who were behind the movement. And here, I could talk about the role of the liberals and the fact that they seem to have been putting much more emphasis on demonstrating than on organizing. And I have to say that this is not a unique to Egyptian phenomenon in that, if you look at, Occupy Wall Street in a completely different part of the world, you find a very similar orientation. A view that kind of traditional organizing, even traditional NGOs, are kind of the old way of doing things. And that, kind of the quick mobilization that has been facilitated by social media, the kind of broad movement without too focused an agenda, is in some sense a superior form of politics because it's procedurally pure. I don't know the Tahrir Square movement as well. Hassan can speak to this more, to what extent it sort of shares those Occupy Wall Street type sensibilities. But the fact remains that going into these elections, the liberals were much less organized than the Islamists. Now, it's not entirely their fault. If you look back at, kind of Mubarak, traditionally he deliberately set up a political arena where it was essentially, the ruling party or the Islamists. He knew that was the best way to maintain Western support for his government. And so there's been a long string of, moderate secular parties that have waited 10 or 15 years to be registered and could have theoretically been using that time to organize had they, had the legal capacity to do so. So it's not entirely their fault. They came in with a massive disadvantage. But that said, there has been, there's been real weakness in terms of classic political organization on the part of the liberal forces. The, the Islamists, I think, have done so well for a number of reasons. I mean, one is indeed that, more classic civil society has been suppressed. The mosque was traditionally, one of the few, if not the only, safe haven around for political activity to take place. They have had, years, decades, to organize within that space and have used that time well. But there's no denying the fact also, and I think this is often forgotten in some of the Western discussions of the Muslim Brotherhood, that Islamically oriented political parties are genuinely popular. That, if you just, kind of ask Egyptians what their sentiments are, clearly a lot of them favor parties that are able to paint themselves in Islamic terms. So, I think that that is a reality that we have to recognize and respect. And respect has not been the traditional Western approach to Islam and to the prospect of Islamic electoral victories. We all remember, what happened to the Fis in Algeria in the early 1990s, where, under the guise that they would somehow pursue an agenda of one man, one vote, one time, there was, the justification offered for the military reversal of the, almost Fis victory, which led to a decade of brutal, bloody civil war. The Bush administration came into office, and after Iraq, after its effort to kind of justify after the fact the invasion of Iraq in pro-democracy terms, briefly adopted this democracy agenda for the region and maintained that until Hamas won in the parliamentary elections and the Muslim Brotherhood did better than expected in the Egyptian parliamentary elections of 7-8 years ago. So, again, a very unprincipled approach to the problem of Islam. The Obama administration came in and was determined to be slightly better than Bush. I mean, they understood the hypocrisy in the Bush approach. Obama gave a speech in Cairo in his first year in office where he went out of his way to stress that this time it would be different. The United States would work with whomever won an election. But the fear of an Islamic victory still very much informs U.S. policy. And you've seen this evidenced in Washington's, you know, hanging on to Mubarak until really the last possible moment when it was pretty clear that he was on the way out. And even now, the kind of mixed messages that they've sent to the SCAF, you know, when this latest round of Tahrir protests took place, you know, and there was brutal repression on the part of the military and the police, Washington's first reaction was, you know, we want restraint on all sides. And it actually took, you know, our Washington director calling them up and saying, you know, what are you guys doing, for them the next day then put out a more appropriately focused statement directed to the military and its abuses. So there is, you know, I think this genuine hesitancy, certainly in Washington, to some degree in Europe as well, to be afraid of the Islamists. And this is, you know, in part going back to Khomeini and what Islam represented there. It's in part a sense that Islam represents a threat to Israel. You know, it's in part a fear that, you know, friendly governments have kind of kept the flow of oil going, have kept stability in the region, and there's no telling what Islamist regimes that are kind of opposed to these traditional Western allies will do. I say all that because I think it's very important to quickly re-examine Western policy toward Islam. And I'll close with this, but I think it is essential that, you know, here we are on the eve of what is very likely to be a rather substantial Islamic victory in the parliamentary elections in Egypt. And what the West should do is to engage, but also press the victors to respect basic rights. I think it would be an enormous mistake to treat Islamic victors as pariahs the way it was done with Hamas in Gaza. That these, you know, as far as we can tell, I mean, it may have been a somewhat skewed battlefield, but you know, I don't think anybody's claiming massive fraud. Any fair reading of this is going to be that, you know, the Islamists won fairly, and that, you know, reflects the current preferences of Egyptians, at least given the political options that were presented to them, which are not perfect options, but that's where we are at the moment. I think this reality has got to be accepted. The goal of Western policy should be to work with Islamists to encourage the elements among them that are willing to live within the constraints that should constrain any government, and those are the constraints of international human rights law. We're seeing, you know, this response has been the way the West, at least initially, is responding to Tunisia. But, of course, Tunisia has been, you know, doesn't have the sort of the Salafist side, which suddenly we're seeing in Egypt. Now, I guess the good news is the Muslim Brotherhood, at least for the moment, you know, remember the history of the feast. They remember what happened to Hamas, and they seem to be going out of their way to present a moderate facade. You know, everybody seems to be looking to the AKP, the Turkish, you know, Islamically oriented party of Erdogan, as something that the West has been able to accept. And that is, you know, a useful model to an extent. I mean, Turkey has a very imperfect human rights record, you know, given the restrictions on free speech, on association, the treatment of the Kurds and the like. But what you can say about Turkey is that the Erdogan government has not used Islam as a reason to suppress rights. And if we could get that from the Muslim Brotherhood, that would be a big step forward. But of course, the real critical issues that we're going to have to look at are the ones that have existed for a long time, and that is, you know, what do we do with the rights of women? What did we do with religious freedom? And what do we do with sort of tricky issues of sexual autonomy and privacy? You know, these classically have been the most difficult issues for Islamists. And I think the role of the West should be to, you know, accept Islam. If that's what the Egyptian people want, that's what they get. But, you know, just as a Christian democratic government in Germany is expected to abide by human rights law, so an Islamically oriented government in Egypt should be as well. And that kind of, you know, acceptance, engagement, and pressure to respect rights should be the nub of Western policy as what is likely to be an Islamically oriented government emerges, all the while maintaining pressure on the military to finally relinquish power and to accept that it, you know, should be operating under civilian oversight without some broad carve-out for its economic interests. I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing this dimension to the discussions. And in some part of the discussion about the winning of Islamists, it's just again taking us back to the situation where these authoritarian regimes were portraying themselves as recipe for stability, either us or chaos, either us or Islamists. It seems somehow even the military council is trying to now play a kind of similar role. But I just want to a very quick note on the Turkish model or the Turkish formula, because even the Turks themselves hate to call themselves as a model because of the deficiencies that you've just mentioned and the shortcomings of their experience so far. But this morning I was in another session where someone has just reminded us of the Pakistani model, actually, which nobody is talking about. It is a state where there is a kind of election, but there is a militarization of the state in such a way, and you can witness that normally when they talk about Pakistan as the most dangerous countries in the world. So just to keep our options open in a way when we discuss the kind of models that Egypt might end up with. And I think this model and how it looks and how the politics internally and so on is what Anthony is going to talk about. Please.
I have to apologize at the outset. I just got back from Cairo and caught a horrible cold on the way, so everybody can bear with a somewhat nasal delivery. I actually just came here to hear Ken and Hassam speak, so I'm not sure how much more nuanced I'm going to be able to be than both of them were. I found myself taking notes in my notebook the whole time. You know, I've, as a journalist, I have the pleasure of not having to make predictions. And in fact, the predictions I've made so far this year have turned out horribly wrong. I thought Mubarak was going to serve out his term. I thought it would matter if the Americans said Bashar should fall. And I thought Tripoli wouldn't fall for weeks. And so I turned out to be wrong on everything that I've guessed at so far. But I think the one idea I try to do with the work is if you talk to enough people, you can get a sense of maybe what's going on. It's something that worked out well in Iraq, and I've tried to do it in the times that I've been in Egypt so far this year. And I think that being able to base the reporting on that has been important, especially when it came to the revolution in Egypt, because there was, I think working at a newspaper like the New York Times, you're dealing with kind of the dominant American sentiments, or let's say Washington sentiments, about what change there represents. And I think from the outset of the revolution in Egypt, it was this notion of the country being delivered to the Brotherhood or Islamists in more general terms. And, you know, it was a tough fight. And I have to say, I went to, there was a, and I was so struck by how what I saw on the ground did not feel that way. If anything, it felt the opposite. And I remember centering a story in Mbaba. People here familiar with Cairo probably know the neighborhood. It's in Giza across the Nile, a very large neighborhood. It's a mixed neighborhood. I mean, there are wealthier elements to Mbaba, but it's often cast by the government, or was cast by Mubarak's government, as this kind of netherworld of crime and danger. And what struck me so much in doing the reporting there over several days in Mbaba was how much that early slogan that we saw during the revolution, the idea of, you know, bread, social justice, and freedom, resonated there. You didn't get the sense that the Brotherhood had a real presence in Mbaba. I think the Salafists probably had more of a presence then, but I didn't notice it as well as I should have. But it wasn't. It was just so striking to me. And I wrote a story back then about how Islamists weren't driving this revolution, how there was this kind of inchoate and somewhat ambiguous energy behind the revolution that was, you know, that was being, I think, incarnated in a lot of ways in Tahrir Square. I agree with what Hassam said about how the revolution in some ways has, you know, was hijacked in March. I think that energy and those demands and maybe those notions of what Egypt was going to be seemed to be somehow, I don't know if the word's diverted or aborted, but I think it was an example of how mismanaged this transition has been since Mubarak fell. I think the referendum that we saw there was a disaster. I think in some ways it polarized the country. It set the political class on a path of utter failure. And I think you can make that declaration about the political class across the board, that it hasn't been able to step up to its obligations in trying to negotiate this transition with the military. And I think then we're now at where we are with the election. And as Hassan rightly pointed out, I think it was a very decisive couple of weeks. Not only what we saw again in Tahrir Square, in part because of the violence that was visited on Mohammed Mahmoud, but also what we can see as indications on where the Islamists are going from here. I think everyone is very right to point out this is, you know, one round in a process that's going to take until March and perhaps even after. It is too early to read anything conclusive, but I think we can, you know, comment or at least kind of reflect on what matters with these elections. I mean, we did see Cairo, Alexandria, and the Red Sea provinces voting, and those are kind of, I mean, as Egypt goes, thought of as more liberal parts of the country. You know, I want to return to Mbab if I can, and this is what's so striking to me to see how these elections did play out. Even when I was in Mbab last month, it was very clear to me that only one faction of the country was organizing. If the Brotherhood didn't have a presence there when I visited in February, it very much had a presence when I was there last month. I think it was two or three offices already set up. Hizb an-Nur, the Salafist faction, was very much a presence there. They were on the ground. They were doing what they had to do in terms of the electoral work. And I had one very memorable scene when I was in the Brotherhood office in Mbaba, and there were two guys who were visiting. They were going from party to party. They went to Gemma, then they went to the Hizb an-Nur, and then they were going to the Brotherhood. They had no sense of where they were going to vote, but they wanted to understand what their vote would mean, and they wanted to understand who would represent their vote. And they ended up with the Brotherhood. And I think the reasons they cited to me were they had political experience. And I think that's one thing that's very interesting to me as we go forward in these months since the revolution, is that in some ways, and I don't want to say this authoritatively, but in some ways it strikes me how much the revolution or the transition is being decided by two institutions that predate the revolution, and that is the Brotherhood and the military. In contrast to the Nahda party in Tunisia, which pretty much was wiped out under Ben Ali, had to rebuild itself in Tunisia after the revolution, had to very forcefully, I think, engage at least in the idea of coalition building. The Brotherhood has relied, as the military has, on its institutional framework that it had pre-revolution. And I think we've seen that play out in a very compelling way. I think the Brotherhood and the military understand each other at some level. I don't want to say their interests intersect by any means, but I think there is somewhat of an understanding. It was remarkable to me on election day to see, well, let me take one step back before there. In the weeks leading up to the election, I think when there was a lot of pressure on the Brotherhood to join the protest in Tahrir, it was amazing to me how defensive the Brotherhood seemed, and two, how scared they were. And I think a lot of the conversations you heard were, one, a reference to 1954, when Abdel Nasser, you know, or however we want to portray those events in 1954, but when there was an assassination attempt and a crackdown, a withering crackdown followed on the Brotherhood. I think 1954 was very much on the minds. The Brotherhood seemed single-minded about getting to the polls, and, you know, it's hard to begrudge them the performance that they seem to have done so far in the first round. I mean, if it is 40%, what, you know, people are talking about. The polling stations I went to in Shobra and Sayyida Zainab, they were there, and they were there forcefully. They were there directing voters. They were there illegally handing out flyers, but pretty much everybody was handing out flyers. And I think they were able to channel what I think is still very ambiguous and amorphous, but a sentiment that that in some ways is a reaction to Mubarak's long years in power. I think the Salafists in some ways fed into that even in a more visceral way. I had this great conversation in Boulat, and I was sitting with a guy who said, you know, how much he didn't pray, he preferred hashish that was grown in Lebanon, but he was definitely voting for the Salafists. And we kept pressing the issue. I really wanted to understand what he was getting at on this. And it was the same conversation I had in Shobra the day before. It was five guys standing in the street. One was voting Brotherhood, the other four were voting Hizb an-Nur. And it was this idea, I think, of, for lack of a better phrase, an unadulterated Islam. They saw that the Salafists were uncompromising. The Brotherhood were somehow compromised by their long years. As I said, as an institution in some ways of the Mubarak years, the Salafists wouldn't compromise. They weren't opportunists. They weren't going to back down after so many years and so many decades of this notion of opportunism and compromise. The Salafists offered something in some ways pristine. Again, this is somewhat superficial, but it was interesting just talking to this one, how this one guy was portraying it to me. And I think that is a powerful current in Egyptian politics today. I think as we go forward, and it's hard not to And I think Hussein said it very correctly. We have to accept, you know, things could get very different. I mean, the idea of elections reaching their end, I don't think is guaranteed by any means. We don't know the intentions of the military right now. We don't know how the West, and I'll get to this later, is going to react to a potential two-thirds majority in parliament. But I think it is going to be a very interesting, exciting, and potentially dangerous step forward as we look at this kind of coming struggle between an empowered parliament and the military. I'm not sure how that's going to turn out, but in some ways I think that is going to be one of the great struggles we see over the next year, is what kind of powers are delineated, how powers are divided, and the posture of the military going forward. And I'm going to get back to that a little bit later when we talk about the military. The other thing I think as we go forward, you know, that's going to be happening perhaps on the sidelines of the struggle between the parliament, let's say a brotherhood or Islamist-dominated parliament, and the military is what both the previous speakers have talked about, and that's, you know, trying to channel what remains, I think, an inchoate force that's often incarnated in Tahrir Square. There is a vitality there. There's an energy there. There is definitely a sentiment that is being voiced, but that yet I don't think has been articulated by any element of the political class. And again, I think when we look back at the transition, it's really important to stress, as much as the military has not been willing to give up power, the political class across the board has failed to deliver. It has failed to, I think, articulate a position, a unified position that would be necessary to try to determine where this transition goes. I know Hussein was there. You know, I was there on Muhammad Mahmoud when these clashes were happening. I'm not sure what my impression was when those clashes ended. I was trying to write a story about this wall that was being built on Muhammad Mahmoud by the army, and it was trying to separate the riot police from the protesters. And I was talking to the young men. I spent the morning just kind of talking to these young men, trying to get what their sense was. And it was an intense feeling, and I'm not sure how relevant it is to politics, but there's an intense feeling of an unfinished, a sense of vendetta, maybe. Of these youth that have had to deal with police for so long, for so many years, of just being, you know, hammered day after day, and that they're going to get some payback. It was very interesting to me how forcefully that was enunciated. It wasn't political necessarily, although I think there is a very political element to it, but it was said almost in conversation after conversation. I think it's a legacy in some ways of Mubarak's rule, and it was very much there. I think there's also that sense of what Tahrir necessarily wants and how it is going to articulate that. There was a joke among some activists that I was standing with in the square that the slogan shouldn't be "the people want the fall of the president," but that some of the protesters should be chanting "the people want the fall of the coming president." And I think that idea of how do we turn this thing into something more practical, more pragmatic, more realistic, and how do we find the elements of the political class or people emerging within the society to articulate those voices and those currents is going to be something that becomes more and more pressing. Maybe the next election, it may be the years ahead, but until that happens, I think this is going to remain a struggle in some ways between the Brotherhood, first and foremost, and the military. As we look to this transition and where this goes forward, I'm struck by this dynamic that I think is already happening in Tunisia to a certain degree, but I think could happen in Egypt more forcefully, and that's the role of the Salafist dragging the debate to the right. When I was interviewing Hanouchi a while back in Istanbul, it was, you know, very clear that he seemed to not register the threat of what, and I think the Salafists have a much smaller constituency in Tunisia, obviously, but that his audience first and foremost were the liberal parties in the country. If they did not engage into some kind of coalition with liberal parties, secular parties, leftist parties in Tunisia, they weren't going to be able to safeguard the experiment going forward, safeguard the building of a parliament that could be, you know, as one of the Nahda party people put it to me, as a charismatic state. I think there's a greater risk in Egypt that the Brotherhood gets dragged to the right, that the Salafists, by being part of the debate, bring up issues that are more social in nature, more cultural in nature, and they force the Brotherhood to address these things. And I think if we see what liberal or leftist voices would see as the most outrageous statements by the Brotherhood, it's almost always in response to a question. They never bring it up on their own. It's in response to a question. When they're forced to respond, when they're forced to answer, this is when we, I think, see the more kind of controversial and sometimes troubling statements. I think the Salafists are going to offer a very provocative role going forward. And I do worry, and I think people with experience, I lived in Egypt in the 90s, and you know, when you had to go month after month of these debates about Nasser Hamed Abu Zayd being divorced from his wife, and just, you know, things that distracted from the issues at hand, part of me does worry that that might become a facet of Egypt's political life. My own sense on this, and I might disagree a little bit with Kenneth on this, and I'm probably wrong, but I mean, it's my own sense is that the military does want an exit out of this, out of where it finds itself. I don't think it wants to rule the country, not in the way that we would see they're doing right now, in this kind of very forceful military rule where they're micromanaging the society, where they're making every decision, and often just delaying decisions. I mean, I think there's numerous examples where, you know, ideas are put forward and they're put on the back burner for 3 months or more. But I think the military very much wants to safeguard, and as Hassan pointed out, I think very rightly, they don't see this as a revolution. They see this as a change in leadership, and how do they keep the privileges they've had under Mubarak's years and before that in place, whether it's economic interests, I think very importantly, immunity for the generals, and also, I think, protection of their budget and some influence, I don't know to what degree, on foreign policy. They're going to want to have a say on foreign policy because it has direct repercussions on where the military's posture is in the country. But I do think they're willing to negotiate this. And I'm not sure the Brotherhood's up for it. I think this is where Ahmed Musa, for instance, sees his role. I think this is where Badadeh, they believe that they can actually offer a way out for the Brotherhood, But I think there will be that sense of negotiating it going forward. How do we position ourselves in the society, protecting our interests, but not being forced to rule in such a visual, direct manner. And that's going to be interesting. I think that's going to very much play into that struggle I talked about earlier between an empowered parliament and the military. If I could add one little wrinkle to that also, and this is, I'd be interested to hear what Hassan says about this, but there was a rally on Friday when there was a big crowd in Tahrir Square. There was a rally in Abbasiya, and it was unlike a rally I had seen in Cairo or in Egypt until then. It was a very militant nationalism. It reminded me of Turkey, to be honest. I mean, nobody can outdo the Turks on nationalism. And it was the flag waving. It wasn't secular necessarily or avowedly. It wasn't Islamist avowedly. It was just, you know, a very militant nationalist expression. And again, I think when we talk about political currents in the country that haven't been channeled or articulated, this is another one that might be interesting going forward. I don't want to read too much into that, but it did strike me as something new that I hadn't seen before, and also something that the military, you know, very much could try to exploit as we go on. You know, when I talked in the beginning about dealing with kind of the sentiments in Washington, I think we have to brace ourselves that there's going to be mass hysteria in Washington when these results really come down. I think people are just going to freak out. And it's going to be, especially for somebody who has to deal with this every day, it's going to be very difficult. They're going to, I think the stories are going to be written of, you know, who lost Egypt. I mean, it's just going to be endless. And, you know, I think it's a shame because I think what we're seeing right now, and I say this, you know, as a reporter, but it's so interesting to me is how one, I think the debate in some ways, and I don't want to overstate this, but I think the debate these days in politics in the Arab world is among Islamists rather than that more traditional Islamist-secular divide. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm not saying it's 100% true, but I think it's becoming more and more that case. And I think it's actually a very refreshing and very positive dynamism that we see in Islamist movements. I mean, we can see people like Hizb al-Wasat in Egypt against the Brotherhood, against the Salafists. We see the same thing happening in Tunisia. I think there's a real potential for good in that. I think there are the dangers that Kenneth pointed out, absolutely. I think the Arab world is going to become a much more culturally conservative, socially conservative place, but I also think it's going to be much healthier, especially as these debates unfurl and get renewed time and again. And I also don't think it can be worse than what we've had to endure for the past 40 years in a lot of ways.
Distinguish between the various Islamist groups and either within a country or across countries, as we're witnessing different positions vis-a-vis different issues. I will have just one question to Behjat regarding the ability of the military council to limit the mandate of the forthcoming parliament. Because as we, or as at least I understand it now, is that the military council has freezed the constitution, and they are acting subject to what they call fouq al-dustur. I'm not sure what is the terms they're using, but at least when the some of the Islamists argues that we want to have a parliamentarian system, it seems that they totally against that, and they said that even the parliament would have some limited power and limited mandate, which probably bring us to the issue of what is the real intention of the military council. If we to read it from the documents or their views, it seems that they want to keep their stake somehow, and that's probably one of the elements that could be discussed. But with this note, we'd like to thank our speaker who has left, Anthony and Keith. Thank you for your view. Thanks.